A cold one masks the abstract. Step back and feel the contrast. Echoes of a broken past. Before my eyes, the future flashed. Concepts, the moment past. Fear of the manifest. Waging battle on my spirit. Surrender to what's fearless. See what bodies mix of love and lust. When love was hard to touch, I toss a prayer your way. Namaste, baby, namaste. Namaste, namaste.
Welcome to Yoga Talk, the Yoga International podcast. That was The Householders with our intro, Namaste Nation. I'm your host, Kat Hegberg. I'm the editor of Yoga International.
And I'm Michael Carlucci. I'm one of the content developers at Yoga International.
And Michael, you and I are not alone today.
We're not alone.
No, we're joined by our dear friend and Yoga International teacher, Lauren Tulin.
Lauren Tulin.
You may have practiced with her, some of her great videos at yi.com.
We have loved Lauren Tulin for so long.
Yeah, thanks, and she's going to chat with us today. Lauren, why don't you tell the listener a little bit about yourself?
Well, it's great to be here, first of all, and I'm happy, so that's something about myself.
Sounds like I'm detecting a Massachusetts accent in there. Are you from the land of Paul Revere and John Adams? Do you have a shrine to the founding fathers in your house?
Yeah, right next to Ganesh. There's me, my boy Paul.
Ganesh,
Paul
one, if by land, one if by land, two if by sea, 20 if by Ganesh.
By Ganesh, yeah, that's right. He holds it together.
All right.
So, yeah, I'm from Massachusetts originally. Now live in and have my school in upstate New York. Mm. And I've been around the yoga world since about 1976 and have been teaching yoga for about 24 years.
Disco yoga.
Yeah. Well, there that yeah, that
I don't
wasn't
know
enough
that ever just, happened.
Just yet. although it wouldn't surprise me if that was the next flavor of yoga. So I run my own school and I ran the certification program for para yoga for many years as well.
Rod Stryker.
Yeah.
Rod Stryker, para yoga, Yoga Rupa G.
Yoga Rupa. But most significantly for purposes of this podcast, I think it's important that I let you guys know that I edited the anatomy and asana columns for Yoga Journal for a couple of years.
Anatomy.
Very cool. Well, first of all, I didn't know that you did that. And I read those columns for years and like, wow. Good job.
Great job, Lauren.
Those are excellent.
Thank you.
And I'm curious, what that must have been kind of challenging, because I would imagine, because anatomy is such a technical, kind of very defined topic. And I would like, was it challenging to try to edit that when you're working with experts in their field to try to make sure that you stayed accurate? But what was that like?
Yeah, well, in terms of the fact-checking, it was very sort of academic and really, I did a lot of the asana that they were talking about right next to my desk, that kind of thing, really embody what I thought that they were trying to get at. So that was a very technical part of it, but then the other half of it was trying to leave them speaking in their own voice and sort of riding that wave of their own style, but then making sure that the information was accurate and applicable.
Yeah.
So like trying to give information, but then empower the students to sort of make it their own and speak it in their own voice.
Well, empower the writers.
The writers.
Yeah, empower the writers. I never changed the tone. It was more about sort of fact-checking and that kind of thing. But again, even some of these, quote, experts would say things that really anatomically didn't make sense, and it sort of, they just were saying something that they thought was accurate, but could have been more accurate. Mm-hmm. So really picking that apart.
I've done similar things with
YI.
And yoga fact checkers, the unsung heroes of...
Oh, yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. Hug your yoga fact checker today, listener.
Hug your yoga fact
checker. If you can find one.
Underneath every great yoga writer is a mountain of fact-checking skulls.
Skulls.
Or they're wearing a mala of them.
Yes. They're wearing a mala of skulls.
Yeah.
So The reason why we asked Lauren to come on the podcast with us today is because we are talking about alignment, Michael's favorite topic.
Okay, alignment. Yeah, I don't know if I'm even going to have anything to say on this podcast. You know, it's alignment, this, anatomy, this. We're so onomia normative, Kat.
Well, Michael, you might be happy to know that we're not going to just geek out on ligaments and tendons and origin and insertion points today. Rather, instead, we're going to talk about why asana cues and alignment cues are not one size fits all.
Right. One size fits all.
Because yoga is not one size fits all.
Yoga is not one size fits all. How many people are on this earth? How many bodies?
7 billion.
Seven billion bodies. And that's only human people. Never mind all the other kinds of people that are
on
the
We're
earth.
Just going to stick to human people
just
today.
Human people?
I think that's our area of expertise.
Embodied. Star Wars Cantina.
Let's talk about embodied people.
Embodied people.
And I love that you brought up onomaya normative. So that outermost covering, but that's where most of us start in our yoga practice. So we have to actually meet people where they are.
Gotta meet people
and
where
they are. And try our best as teachers and practitioners to meet the person where they are, the individual. And that's why a lot of these universally accepted and propagated cues don't actually work for everybody.
No. And, you know, a lot of my training was in Anusara. And I'm really very grateful for all of the alignment and the anatomy and the philosophy that I learned from some really phenomenal teachers when I was studying that style. But one thing that style did really focus on was what they called universal principles of alignment. The idea that alignment, and more so particular alignment cues, were always applicable to every person in every pose. Mm-hmm. And so it took me a really long time to kind of get out of that mindset. The idea that not every cue, not every order of teaching alignment or anything is going to be appropriate for every person.
Well, I think that those are still adaptable and applicable. And all those loops and spirals give us a place to start, but it's certainly not the place that we should finish, especially regarding our own practice, first and foremost, and then secondly, how we offer that to others in terms of our teaching, because it doesn't land on everybody the same way.
Yeah, no, things can be taken so many different ways, too. Mm-hmm. And you know, what really comes up for me when I start to think about cues that are sort of given as though they're one size fits all, the cue that comes to mind first for me is tuck your tailbone.
Yeah.
I've written a lot about why I don't like that cue. We can link to those articles in the show notes. And for me, a lot of it really even goes back before I started practicing yoga to ballet class.
Ballet, of course.
Yeah, and my teachers would always say, Kat, tuck your tailbone. Tuck your tailbone. Because I tended to present with an overarched lower back.
Right.
And I would get so frustrated because I'm like, okay, I'm tucking as best as I can, and it wouldn't help.
Right.
And the reason why is because where I was overarching, where that was happening for me, it was much higher up in my lower back. So for me, an instruction to perhaps draw my low ribs back would have been much more helpful.
Yeah.
And
right.
that's the case with a lot of students too. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And not everybody is truly what we call lordotic or has a hyper curve in their low back.
Yeah.
So it could be that they have more flesh there, and they have
a bigger butt.
Yeah, if you've
more junk in the trunk.
More junk in the trunk, and that's an illusion. The other thing we need to consider is that the tailbone does not move in isolation; that it's attached to the sacrum. So we need to be a little more universal. Sometimes we're too specific. Here we need to be less specific and move the. You talk about moving the sacrum or even the pelvis. Now, tucking the pelvis, something like that. But actually, again, bringing that out from that very minor or minute point out into a bigger scheme of things is that we want to also draw the abdomen up. And you were talking to me earlier about the action of the transverse abdominis, the lower abdominal muscles, that those would engage. Everybody try that as you're listening right now. Right?
Okay, hold up.
So if you just draw the lower abdomen in and up, you'll feel the sacrum firming and then the tailbone tucks, but that's not the primary movement.
I just felt all of my knotties engage.
Exactly.
Like, lock and load.
Like the lotus in my heart is spinning a little bit.
Lock and load.
And I think, too, it's important to be clear about, you know, how much we want somebody to do something, because you don't want to erase your lumbar curve. Like, you have a curve there for a reason, and you can tuck so much that you flatten out, and that's not very useful. You were talking about, too, this morning, Lauren, about how when we do this chronic tucking of the tailbone, that's not necessarily the best thing as far as our pelvic floor goes.
Exactly. Yeah. There's you know, one of the kind of hot topics out there is hypertonic pelvis, which creates pelvic pain and all sorts of hormonal and elimination issues and that kind of thing.
In prenatal yoga, that's a huge topic, too.
And so why would we want to augment someone who tends to have a lot of stress and strain down there by telling them sort of offhand, tuck your tailbone, tuck your pelvis? Again, not a universal truth and something that we shouldn't just accept without investigation.
Does hypertonic mean, it doesn't mean lordosis, it means kind of the opposite.
No, it means your pelvic floor is
too
like
tight.
Yeah. Which kind of paradoxically, when it's really tight like that or hypertonic, it can also weaken the pelvic floor.
Yeah.
Well,
I guess
that makes sense, because like if you're walking around with, you know, chronic tension, then you're sort of unconsciously, for one reason or another, engaging muscles that probably should be relaxed, which of course is one of what we're trying to do in yoga anyway. I mean, we can point to the Yoga Sutra and find that, but so yeah, I would imagine that in the long run, any hypertonic anything would probably weaken you.
Definitely weakens.
Yeah, so I think like the grand takeaway from this one is, if you see your student or yourself and you think, oh, well, their low back or my low back is a little too archy, then tuck your tailbone is not the universal cure-all for that. That, you know, we really have to look at where that's coming from, if it's actually an issue, and then address people as individuals, not as A plus B equals C. Everything.
And, you know, it's like, it's another thing. It's like sometimes yoga language is very aggressive. You know, like when I hear tuck this, tuck that, it's like, it sounds like you're kind of like shouting at me to do a thing, when what is natural.
Do a
is,
thing, Michael.
Do a thing. You know, well, doing a thing is good, but we want to engage in skillful action, right? And, you know, in Qigong, we have this idea of Wu Ji or No Qi, but it's also called opening the heaven's gate, which is a very gentle and light tucking of the pelvis, but it's so subtle that it's just a sort of an engagement. It's not this heroic wrenching, turning of the screw, tucking of the pelvis like, Kat, you probably experienced in ballet. Certainly I did too. So it's like, I think messaging is important in a yoga class, to the point of getting the student to just gently engage and bring awareness to.
I agree.
Rather than heroically wrenching at something.
Yeah, I think the action words are very, very important, those verbs that you use. So
words are important, dear listener. Words are important.
You're listening to words right now.
You're listening to words. We're making words.
So speaking of some other words that maybe might not be that helpful, what about pull your shoulders down away from your ears?
Hear shoulder blades?
All the time, either, really. Yeah. Pull your shoulder blades down. Pull your shoulders down. And we could talk about the difference between shoulders and shoulder blades, too. Like, shoulders on your back and shoulder blades on your back mean two very different things. But something that we hear a lot is pull your shoulder blades down. And really, anatomically, that's not a very useful, it can even be a dangerous cue as far as rotator stuff goes, because when we lift the arm, naturally what happens is the shoulder blade has to come along too, and the rib cage too, and everything moves as one unit in order for the movement to be integrated and safe.
Mm-hmm. Dear listener, you can't see this, but Kat and Lauren are delightfully actually doing this in the studio right now. It's kind of funny to watch.
Yeah, so without getting too geeky, I'll try to give you the nutshell version. We have three different bones that make up the shoulder girdle. Mm-hmm. The upper arm bone, the humerus, the clavicle or the shoulder, the collarbone, and then that shoulder blade. So they all need to move in sync. And moving those shoulder blades down the back creates a lot of strain. Again, listeners, give it a try. What happens to the base of your neck?
Wow,
it's not. It's not a fun place. So,
it's true. When I do that, I notice a kind of a shot of tension happens in my neck, which I'm almost at a loss for words. But it's sometimes when I'm doing something, I find things happen other places in my body. That's
Well, we're our bodies are connected.
Are you suggesting our bodies are connected and that we're not, like the tailbone doesn't live in isolation?
Nothing lives in isolation.
And our spine doesn't live in everything?
We could have a discussion about fascia too.
Fascia?
Not maybe this time.
Not this
but
time, yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, Lauren, like you were saying, exactly, like for an integrated movement to happen, we can't isolate in that way. Mm-hmm. And especially like what you were talking about with the neck, I would imagine like in poses like shoulder stand or bridge pose,
oh,
that can be really dangerous.
Wow, really dangerous. Consider the cervical spine, you know, itself, the vertebrae of the cervical spine are not that big. So let's actually have most of the weight on the shoulder girdle and the upper arm so that you're supporting where you should be supporting. If you draw your shoulder blades down and you're upside down like bridge or shoulder stand, you're resting on your neck, which is just not a great place
to
be.
No.
Yeah, and I think a lot of times teachers will give that cue because we don't want, you know, we feel a little scrunchy in our necks and we feel like shoulders are way up high. But really, if you're lifting everything, if you're lifting the rib cage along with the shoulder blade, then that should stay relaxed.
It should stay relaxed.
And we have a great article on yogainternational.com written by Amber Burke called Keeping the Doctor Away, 10 Doses of Yoga Alignment for Preventive Physical Therapy that we will link to in the show notes if you want to really geek out on that and some other alignment stuff too.
Mm-hmm.
What about, and this is really during Chaturanga that we hear this, what about hug your elbows into your rib cage?
Yeah, that's problematic as well, I see, because it really, when, again, if you might want to try this as you're listening, hug those, bend your elbows and hug the upper arm bones into your rib cage. What does that do to your upper arm bones? It draws them forward.
Oh yeah, I'm really rounded
here.
Towards
the front of your body, so you're rounding the shoulders. And when we want to be in Chaturanga, that four limbed pose, we want the collarbones to actually float free and move forward, not down and compress into the body. So I think we need to be more reasonable about that universal cue. It's not into, let's use a different preposition. Mm-hmm. How about toward?
Sure.
Especially if the person has a tendency to do the, what I call the funky chicken arms.
Oh, like you're doing like a military push-up or a chest push-up. We don't want to do that.
No.
So,
yeah.
You know, like something you just said, interesting, the language, I'm kind of geeking out, the word you choose to use rather than into or toward. And what came up for me immediately is intentionality. And the preposition, this is really esoteric, but the preposition seems to point to something that's subtler than the body, which is what are you intending to do by taking the pose? And when you said that, heading toward, that makes me think engaging again rather than necessarily really making a certain shape. And I just wanted to
agree, because what are we trying to do with our yoga practice? We're not trying to necessarily perfect the form so that we can be on the cover of yoga journal or something like that. It's not about an external prettiness. It's about bhavana, right? It's about that intention. It's about creating a certain feeling. And we want to do that in a way that has that brings us into that sukha, into that good space, if you will. Alignment is very important. It's very important. However, if we get entrapped in that alignment, we really are going to get ourselves stuck and not allow our mind to spin out into actually the feeling of the pose, which is supposed, that's what empowers our practice.
Alignment really is not about what the pose looks like. Alignment is about what the pose is doing.
Right.
Yeah. It's not like you go to Thanksgiving and you have a big discussion about like the measurements of the house and that it's 10 feet by, you know, or the room is like 40 feet by 50 feet or what kind of wood the table is. It's all about the joy and the uplift that you're having with one another. That's, you know, the house is
and
the structure.
Stuffing.
And the stuffing, and the gravy, maybe some cranberry relish. I love Thanksgiving. It's one of my favorite.
But it's about let's go home.
Let's feel home. Make sure there's no snow falling in after a winter in the Northeast here. It's, you know, no snow's coming
right
into
Thanksgiving. Nothing's collapsed, but that's the point. We want to have four walls, a ceiling, and a floor, and we want to know that they're there supporting us.
Yeah.
That's where alignment comes in to spin the metaphor back to what we're
actually
talking about.
Yeah, and you know, when it comes to hugging the elbows into the rib cage, I have a lot of gratitude for my teacher in New York, Julie Dorman. Shakti Yoga NY. Check her out.
Shakti.
Because she was the first person who told me, hey, Kat, don't squeeze your elbows into your rib cage. Like, what if you let them flare out a little bit? And as soon as I did that, my chaturanga felt so much better. Mm-hmm. For me, that meant that my elbows pointed out maybe about toward the back edges of my mat. It wasn't like those chicken wings like you were talking about, but there was just a little bit more space so I could stay broad through my collarbones. And it really changed my practice. And I feel like it kept me from a lot of, I've not had a rotator cuff injury from chaturanga yet, and I hope to never have one. And I really credit her for that and that awareness for that.
Well, there are a lot of other sort of injury-like conditions we can bring to ourselves besides rotator cuffs from doing
that's
that.
That's true.
But if I could just bring it back to sort of my background, one of my first loves in yoga when I happened upon an actual school was Iyengar yoga, and that's known to be, you know, extremely alignment oriented and prop intensive. But what Mr. Iyengar has said, that what is yoga, hatha yoga, is spreading effort and consciousness throughout the body.
Ooh, I like
and,
that.
And that's an important point to note at this point. So this elbow hugging, crunching of the shoulders, all of that kind of thing, really brings us an intense experience, which we are actually, it's sort of avidya. We're not really, the intensity should be spread equally and evenly. And that's where we get, you know, Iyengar is famous for being quoted as enlightenment through alignment. So you could have a really intense experience in the shoulders or the neck or whatever, but don't let that fool you. In other words, we want to have that.
It's like a delicious food. You could have a really intense experience on your tongue, you know, by eating an ice cream sundae or something like that. But there's more to it than ice cream sundaes.
You have to eat your kale too.
You have to eat some kale. Yeah. You know, get some fiber, maybe some, you know, omega threes
or sixes
So all the omegas.
What about that whole one breath per movement thing? We were talking about that earlier.
One breath per movement.
Yeah, one breath, one movement. I think this is fairly ubiquitous in a lot of vinyasa classes, and particularly power vinyasa classes, which, again, hearkening back to my geeky Iyengar past, he talks about the yoga of action versus the yoga of momentum. And one breath, one movement is all well and good if you're really letting it land on you in that class as a student. But at the same time, that instructor is up there cueing you at her pace, or what she believes to be is the sort of median pace of the class, where you're not even able to catch your breath.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's sort of antithetical to have that one breath, one movement be on someone else's metronome, if you will.
Totally, totally.
Get into the pacing of your breath, and then that might work for you.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you really need to throw that out the window and certainly be guided by that person in the front of the room, but your primary teacher is the flow of your own breath.
So what a revolutionary thought. I mean, we did start the program by talking about being from Massachusetts, the land of the revolution.
Yeah.
But are you putting forth the revolutionary notion that we should be focusing on our breath in a yoga class?
Yeah, I guess I am, and that's pretty radical. You know, I'm part of that whole first tea party, the one that's going on now.
Boston Tea Party.
The Boston Tea Party.
But you know, like, I mean, the thing about the breathing, it's like as an artist, as an actor, as a former dancer, I've done some crazy experiments, and I've noticed that when I take yoga class, that I'm really only doing what the teacher is saying, like focusing on your breath. But if I actually do focus on my breath and I play with my breath, sometimes it really makes me stand out in the yoga class and marginalizes me. And then it has this sort of almost disruptive effect to the groupthink of the class.
Exactly.
And I really think it comes back to the whole idea of one size doesn't fit all, but yet we're in a class that's a kind of a group or a walking class or something like this, where it used to be a one-on-one experience. I mean, you would never go to the doctor's office and then there'd be 40 of you in one room and the doctor's, okay, everybody take this pill.
Right. Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. So there's that, you know, there's a balancing act there. There really is a balancing act. And people go to group classes because they want to be in a group. They want to be in a community. They want to see other people and they want to learn something. But if all you're kind of experiencing is this huffing and puffing and trying to keep up, it's not going to land very well.
So it sounds like maybe if I were practicing on my own, like one breath per movement could be useful. But if I were a teacher in a class saying, all right, everybody, one breath per movement, and I'm guiding the movement, that might not be so helpful.
Exactly. And then you get caught in the intensity of momentum, which is, again, antithetical, really, to what we're trying to do with our hatha practice, which is to get to know ourselves a little bit better and to love ourselves a little bit more. And if you're trying to meet a standard that just doesn't work for you, there's a disconnect.
Yeah. There's a disconnect. And actually, I would go so far as to say it's actually harmful, because if you're really trying to kind of soothe your breathing and soothe
and
your heart
system.
Pattern and your nervous system, then lurching into somebody's external breath pattern without the right vidya would actually be potentially harmful, at least subtly harmful.
It's subtly harmful, and you know, when you go subtle, you go deep. And so over the long term, not so subtle. Mm. So let's work to get to know what works for our own nervous system. And
let's investigate. Let's be curious about what's happening.
Exactly.
Let's be curious.
Exactly.
And you know, sometimes it's not even just the things that we say in yoga class that could perhaps be a little bit too generalized or even problematic, but it's the way that we say them. Like if we use language that's not inclusive, or if we take a negative tone, that can be equally frustrating for students.
Right, or simply distracting. So we may want to have the student sort of be in that be here now state, and so we'll say, don't think about your grocery list, which will trigger people to think about their grocery list.
I never think about my grocery list, like even in the grocery store, unless my teacher says that in
right.
class.
And this is one thing that my friend, I was talking to her about doing this podcast, and she said, make sure you mention that. And so the seeds that we plant can be either, you know, bring us to a deeper intelligence or bring us to a great distraction. So we want to sound profound and we want to sound helpful and nurturing, but be very careful about the tone and the tone of your metaphor, and have more of a yes and kind of flavor
Michael,
what
your
you're
thing.
Saying
well, you know, you're
rather than a
language.
No but.
Yeah, no but.
Yeah.
No but blocks the flow. Yes and goes with the flow. And, you know, part of the whole thing about the languaging that's so significant is I think all of us who went to school here in this culture, it's like we're all afraid of public speaking. Kat and I mentioned this on a podcast, a couple of podcasts ago, that it's like public speaking is more scary for people than like even dying. And it's like we want to say things profound in a yoga class, but it actually is somewhat more harmful when if we learn how to surf on the waves of silence, you know, and saying something that's really from the heart
right.
rather than from the head, I think that is a little bit more authentic and actually has a better effect. But then, of course, people are going to think, well, I got to speak from my heart and not my head, and like, I'm a bad person. It's like, hold on here. Just relax. Relax into your own beautiful nature and speak from your own truth.
Maybe say a little less.
Say less.
Say a little less. But I think also that's why so many teachers pull out the Rumi book or the Rilke book.
Oh, sure.
And will quote some from someone else's heart, which... It's all well and good.
I'm totally fine with that, because if they've put it in their own heart, Rumi or Shakespeare.
Yeah, if it's meaningful to them.
Or like you, John Adams, you know, then.
Yeah, exactly.
Lauren, do you quote John Adams in the beginning of your yoga class?
Give me liberty or give me... No, that wasn't John Adams. That was John Henry?
It was somebody.
It was one of those old guys.
I hope none of our friends in Washington, D.C. are listening to this and getting mad at me for misquoting the founding fathers.
I hope you all are. So to close off that little topic, don't fret about what you're going to say, but less is always more in this case. And
let's even flip it right now. Let's go to Yoga Sutra 233 and flip it from a don't fret about what you're going to say to something like invite yourself to speak
there we
from
are. Thank you.
Authentic presence or something like that.
Amen.
Huh?
And do your own breathing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And Lauren, what about the way we speak about things like props?
Well, here we have it. There's two enemy camps there with a bunch of people wandering around in the middle of that field. And there are, you know, some popular pervasive schools out there that really denigrate the use of props, that say that they're for sissies or they're a distraction or that they're crutches. Mm. And then there's this pendulum can swing all the way to the other side that you should hardly ever do a pose without a prop.
Sure.
And I'm in the middle somewhere where, again, it's about intelligent use of your own body, your own prana, your own mind, and intelligent use of tools. So what I tell in my teacher training is I say, because I have a lot of people who come from straight vinyasa where they're, all they have is a mat.
They've
got a mat.
Yeah.
Maybe a block.
Maybe like one block.
That sits at the front of their mat and they never use
exactly.
it. It's sort of like, you know, a vase or something. And
a vase without flowers.
A vase without flowers, yeah, or water. So what I often will tell my yoga students in my teacher trainings around maybe their reticence to use props is I go to the story of Jane Goodall, the
Jane Goodall.
Famous primatologist.
Love Jane Goodall.
Who made tremendous discoveries from studying her beloved chimpanzees. And one of the first things that really gave her a street cred was that she found out that they were super intelligent. And how did they, what was the finding? That they were able to use tools.
Oh, the termites, yeah.
Yeah, the chimps used little sticks to go into the termite mm-hmm. mound and then they just scoop them off the stick. So their ability to use tools show that they were highly intelligent beings. So I would like to take that right into our yoga practice.
Oh, I like that.
Use tools intelligently and help us to find that beautiful spread of consciousness, ease, and effort that we talked about. Again, it's not a crutch, it's a tool.
Yeah. Well, you know, and
I got a funny story I want to relate about that because when I was studying Ballet Cat, and you might appreciate this, I realized that the bar, it was a tool.
The bar is a prop.
The bar is a prop. So, but the thing about it
I'd like to prop myself up on bars a lot.
the thing about the bar was is that when I would go into my releves, I would like hammer on the bar. I would like do push-ups against the bar. I would spin myself
that
around.
That doesn't surprise
me. And in classical ballet class, they really didn't like that. And like my teacher Natalia would be like, "Why don't you just do the thing I'm asking you to do?" But I'm like, "But I got to find my core strength, and I'm got to move around, and I got to really rest with this bar." So I mean, like I'm actually completely and totally in your camp there, Lauren. The one camp of the denigrators and the one camp of the eschewers. I can't remember, but yeah, for me, I like to use a prop. Actively, so I don't like try to just rest on the prop or the block or the strap. I'm like yanking it and pushing against it, and again,
well,
it kind of marginalizes me in yoga class.
Well, you
so.
Could have a whispered conversation with it.
Sometimes I like to shout. Sometimes I like to whisper. That's what I'm saying. I want to tell jokes to the block. I want to like tell the block things that the block didn't know about itself. You know, I want to like give it a little deep tissue to the mat. You know.
Well, you know, the point that you make there too is, I guess I do feel very fortunate, and this can certainly go to an extreme, of course, but coming from primarily alignment-based schools, I never thought of props as crutches. I always kind of thought of them from the beginning as ways to enhance my alignment. Like the block was more, okay, well, this is something that I can place between my thighs so I can feel them engage while I internally rotate them, and I can use the block to help me with that. So it was more about enhancing an action than it was about, making a pose, quote unquote, easier. That
right.
said, just because you need a prop or you choose to use a prop, or maybe you would benefit from using a prop, it doesn't mean that you're, quote, less advanced. It might just mean like, hey, you have really long legs, so the floor is further away, so maybe you need a block under your hands to bring the floor up to you.
Yeah, I think that prop usage, whether it's a block or strap or, you know, hello, a mat is a prop.
Yeah.
Let's call it what it is.
A shoe is a prop. You know, your yoga pants are a prop, sort of. I mean,
well,
they're functional. Let's just say that.
Okay. So it's about building intelligence, about building in physical intelligence, pranic intelligence, mental intelligence. Go through the koshas if you want. But this, if using props or tools helps you to become more intelligent in your practice, you should definitely use them. Mm. If not using them creates more stress and strain, and you have to discern whether that intensity of experience is not necessarily bringing you into more intelligence. It's just making it harder. So be discerning about that.
Yeah. And as teachers,
use props. Use them.
And as teachers, we need to not put value judgments on the props too. As in, like, well, if you're more advanced, do this. Or if you need a prop, do this.
Certainly.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree with that.
Another
we don't
great
want stepchildren in our class.
Yeah, right.
Another great YI writer, Amber Carnes, writes about this very eloquently in an article she wrote recently on how to make classes more inclusive and the way that we language invitations to utilize props, and we will also link to that in the show notes. Another kind of interesting topic when it comes to how we language is very practical. And it's, you know, just like using set distances to describe alignment.
Right. Oh, God, yeah.
Like step your feet 4 feet apart or
right.
3.5 feet apart.
Yeah.
Well, that's
three to 4 feet apart.
Yeah.
That's not helpful.
Two cubits.
It might as well be cubits, yeah. really. Because depending on proportions, if someone has a very long torso and maybe shorter legs, it's going to look very different for them to step their feet 3.5 to 4 feet apart and fold into Prasarita Padottanasana than it is for someone with long legs and a shorter torso.
Well, again, you know, just sort of throwing out those universal measurements that don't really apply. If you're a teacher, it's your job to look at every student in the room and actually teach that person. And it literally takes 2 seconds to say, Mary Jane, step your feet wider.
Mm-hmm. What about, here's another one that we hear a lot as far as universal cues go. Square your hips.
Squaring the
hips. Mm.
And there's, you know, there are poses where that is pretty much a useful cue. Like if you're in a lunge and your back heel's lifted, or if you're in a Tadasana at the front of the mat, that might be helpful. But when we get into like our warrior ones and our Parsvottanasana, which listener, you might know as pyramid pose, then that cue.
Or pigeon.
Yeah, exactly. Then those cues can be even kind of dangerous for our knees.
Right. Knees and for our SI joints
and
our groin, you know, all of the structures in the groins as well. So I agree with you again, and it's a matter of nuance in the languaging. Mm. So square your hips toward the front, I think, is better because we want to have that action be, say, my left leg is back. I really do want to have the left side of my hip, my ilium, move forward, but it doesn't have to be in absolutely parallel with the front of the mat, and we might be better served or serving our students better if we cue from below that. So to spin that back leg in more and then spin and then go above that point, which you love as a teacher.
The belly, yeah. Mm.
Turn your tummy.
Draw the back leg side of the belly toward the front leg side. Yeah. That's a cue I'll use a lot. Yeah.
So I use the turntable.
Oh, like, I love that.
Move your guts like a turntable.
Move your guts like a turntable. Like you're doing some DJing.
I love that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We can borrow that. Dubs of whoa, whoa, whoa,
whoa. So that's really important. And you know, listeners, jot that down because I think that's something that will be really fun and enlightening for you to explore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm.
Another thing we hear a lot too is this kind of idea that permeates yoga classes that flexing the foot will automatically protect the knee, no matter what pose you're in. And yes, there are some poses where flexing the foot can be helpful as far as keeping your knees safe and happy, but that's certainly not the case in every pose.
Right. Right.
Like pigeon pose, for example. If you're in a pose where your shin is straight across horizontal, like thread the needle, Suchi Rudrasana, some people call it, that pose goes by a lot of names, hip cradle lying on your back, then certainly that could be useful. Or like a seated baby cradle or fire log.
Yeah, absolutely.
You want to flex your feet there. Yeah. But we'll show you later, Michael.
All right.
Listener, you can Google if you're not familiar with
those. I see what you're doing, Lauren. It's the,
I call it leg baby.
Sorry, dear listener, you can't see, they're acting out some of these things. So.
We're pantomiming for Michael.
We're learning plus performing the podcast.
But pigeon pose, you know, most people, myself included certainly, don't really get the shin totally parallel with the front of the mat. We have to have the heel in a little bit closer to the pelvis in order to keep our hips level in the pose. And in that case, flexing the foot can sickle the ankle.
Yeah.
And
it makes it less possible for you to flex the foot. So that cue doesn't even make sense there.
No.
So then again, what do? We go back, grow your pose from the inside out.
Grow your pose from the inside out. Now that, Lauren, I love. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt your flow there.
No, you didn't. And we'll go up to, we've got two sets of bones that make up the knee joint. So let's go to the bone set that's above the knee and work on spinning that thigh bone out more in pigeon, for instance. So you're rotating the thigh bone, which is going to take the possibility of the knee twist away.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, if you might be asking, well, if I don't flex my foot or try to flex my foot, what do I do with my foot? back in my Anusar days, we had a term called floint that I still think is kind of helpful.
And it's basically,
yeah, it's just point your foot, but flex your toes back. Kind of like if you were wearing a shoe with the high heel, as I am right now, actually. You would have your foot in that kind of high heel shoe position or a kind of flex point hybrid. And that usually helps the ankle to stay a little straighter. And if you really want to geek out on it, kind of the cool thing is by spreading your toes in that way, you activate the muscles on the sides and the back of the shin. And by lifting the heel up, you even can make it a little more accessible to get that external rotation
that
Lauren
rotation
was talking about.
Thigh. Be careful about that, what you're asking yourselves and your students to do when you sort of just throw those words out there. What do they really mean and how are they landing on that person?
Mm-hmm.
Extremely important.
Absolutely.
Do you ever wonder if there's an alignment cue for voice?
Amber Burke wrote an article about that, actually. I'll send it to you.
Oh, the yoga talk thing?
I think she had a different one.
Oh.
It could have been that one, though.
Or yoga speak. Maybe. No, sorry, yoga
where,
speak.
Where the yoga talk thing, Lauren?
I'm sorry. I apologize. You are the thing. You're all
I forgot. That was the name of our podcast.
And the bag of chips. But the yoga speech, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Inhale.
And she kind of...
Exhale.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So what about this one? If you guys heard this one, in triangle pose, imagine you're stuck between two panes of glass.
Mm. Oh, my God, that's scary.
I know. So that's like to me
doesn't
when I hear
like
that.
A good space to me.
No. What I always think about when I hear that is when I was a kid, my aunt found a dead butterfly outside, and she brought it inside and pressed it between two panes of glass and like hung it up like art. And
she was giving that butterfly a triangle assist.
Yeah.
And so I would always be kind of fascinated by this like dead butterfly smushed between this glass. And I think about that when I hear that cue and mm-hmm. I want to be a dead butterfly.
No,
I want to be a live butterfly.
Yeah. That's the definition of dukkha, isn't it? That's not good space. And anatomically it at most it's dangerous at least it's sort of unskillful because you have to consider that the pelvis, the sides of the pelvis are attached to each other and they can't move independently like the shoulders do.
Mm.
So we have really only one hip girdle and two shoulder girdles. So we could stack the shoulders between those two panes, but not the hips, especially in asymmetrical standings. We want to have that top hip be slightly forward. Honor the width of your hips so that you're not straining all of the...
And plus, panes of glass are so fragile and brittle. It's like you're not a fragile, brittle. Better to give the cue of like, imagine that you're standing between two panes of lasagna noodles like two
which
pieces
makes
of flan.
Absolutely no sense. I like flan too. But yeah, the glass being fragile, this is going to make your pelvis, your SI joints, and all of your ligaments and your connective tissue in the pelvis more fragile, I believe. And we just don't want to do that anymore.
No.
So let that one go on to the compost heap.
Mm-hmm.
Compost the panes of glass cue.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we have one more point to talk about today. And this is one that Michael and I addressed before in podcast number two.
Podcast two, yoga myths, mm-hmm. Hanuman, Sita. No,
not
those guys.
Kind of myths.
Not that myth.
We talked about myths about yoga, meaning a little bit of like what we're talking about today.
Myths.
Some general misconceptions. Like who yoga is for. Some maybe preconceived notions that might be prevalent about yoga.
Mm.
And one of the things we talked about is this question, can we practice inversions as when we're menstruating, basically.
Uh-oh.
So that's what we're going to talk about here. We're going to get some
insights
from Lauren. If you want to learn a little bit more about kind of like the science behind that and some studies that have been done, check out podcast number two, and we will link to some studies in the show notes. But what are your thoughts on that, Lauren?
Well, these are my thoughts, and this came from sort of one of my beloved and a little bit radical teachers, Barbara Baynaw, who... I don't know, more than a decade ago, we talked about this, that there was this, you know, hard and fast rule that inversions during menstruation is verboten because you will immediately be stricken with endometriosis if you go upside down.
Wow. An idea that science has debunked, by the way.
Yeah. Oh. And she said, you know, let's take this on a case-by-case basis. Mm. And we feel like... We want to be smart and go with the science. But as you said, that's what we used to think that science was. It's not right. that anymore. The truth is evolving in this case. And I think the best thing for you to do is to experiment whether going upside down bothers you or not. I mean, exactly. the purpose of menstruation is you know, the down and out. Going upside down may affect you, may give you more cramping or more flow or whatever it is, or it may not. So that's where I'm sort of standing on that, is on, it's definitely on a case-by-case basis, and you have to try it out in your own body.
And I mean, inversions fall into a lot of different categories.
Down
too.
Dogs and inversion.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, like for me, my main sort of what you might think of as like a quote traditional inversion that I practice is handstand. And when I don't change up my practice during menstruation, but that's partially because when I go up into a handstand, I'm there for like maybe 10 seconds at
that's
most.
That's the other thing I was going to mention. And we're not hearing necessarily that running is contraindicated.
Yeah.
And that seems like a much more sort of jarring and almost violent thing to do during your menses than sort of staying in downward facing dog for five breaths or headstand. Again, see if it works for you.
Yeah, and I can't help but wonder, like, maybe how many of these ideas are maybe rooted a little bit in patriarchal
masculine.
I'm gonna run, dear listener. I'm about to run. I'm gonna go camping. Right, we didn't hear the camping was contraindicated either, did we?
Well, that's another old wives' tale that you shouldn't go camping on your period because you will be attacked by bears. I think that one is not the case.
Learn that from Anchorman.
You did.
Yeah. Pearls of wisdom just dropping all over the place in that movie.
It's not anecdotal evidence, dear listener. I learned it on Anchorman.
But I think you raise a really good point, Lauren, that instead of, you know, just reading an article that says don't do this and saying, oh, yes, I'm taking this at face value, you know, we should maybe pay attention to what's happening in our own bodies. And if your teacher says we're going to do a shoulder stand and your body tells you, oh my gosh, I'm hella crampy right now and that's going to feel terrible, don't do it. Mm-hmm. If you think, great, this is going to feel really lovely to just stretch out in this way, and you know that it's a pose that's part of your regular practice, then do it.
Right, right. And I'll say that rule came out, I believe, it's my understanding, of the Iyengar Yoga School. And you know, I don't think we'll be able to get Gita Iyengar here on another Gita Iyengar.
We're blowing up, Lauren. Don't doubt what we can do.
Gita Iyengar, if you're
of.
Listening, we would love to have you on the podcast.
Yeah. But she might have something much more erudite to say about this topic. But
we'll leave it.
You're your
that.
Own petri
you
dish.
More, try more it erudite than Steve Carell from Anchorman? I don't know.
Maybe we'll get him on the podcast too. Well, Lauren, thank you so much for chatting with us today and dropping those, as you said, pearls of wisdom. I learned a lot from talking to you. I hope our listeners did too. And guys, you can check out some great videos with Lauren at yogainternational.com. She has a lot of great classes. And as soon as we finish up this podcast, she's going to film another class for us.
There's no rest for the wicked. We'll have something coming soon.
No, very exciting to be here. And it was a lot of fun. And I just want to leave you with this sort of quote, because I looked it up just for this podcast, by that guy named Socrates.
Socrates.
His quote is, "An unexamined life is not worth living." So let's take that onto our mat as well.
Yeah. Amen.
Yeah. Amen. Thanks.
And listener, if you have any insights to add, if you have any cues that you found not so helpful, any maybe universal alignment that you discovered was not so universal, or just anything that you want to share with us, please shoot us an email at yogatalk@yogainternational.com. Also, don't forget, we have a Q&A episode coming up soon. So if you have any questions about yoga, anything at all, everything from alignment stuff to yoga history to Ayurveda, please send us your questions. We will do our very best to talk to the experts and wise folks that we know and find you some answers for that Q&A episode. And you can send those questions as well to yogatalk@yogainternational.com. And we are going to take you out with our dear, dear friends, the Householders.
The Householders.
They have a new album dropping soon.
New
More
album.
About that later.
2 weeks.
Yeah. Namaste, namaste, namaste nation.
When I free my mind, shakes force arise. Baba now, word vibrates in the sound. Take the light for granted, with the unconscious dance.